Our series, as the video showed, Hope in the Wilderness, started last Sunday. And much of last Sunday, we spent looking at how the book of Genesis leads us into the beginning part of the book of Exodus. We find ourselves in the country of Egypt. And the people that we're following is the family whose story is told in the book of Genesis. And we looked at how we looked at God's plan of how is he going to overcome evil and sin that was introduced into the world in Genesis 3. And God's plan to overcome these things through the offspring of the woman. And so we recount the story of this family all the way to the beginning part of Exodus, where this family numbers 70 people in the nation of Egypt. And then in verse 7 of chapter 1 that we looked at last week, it says that they grew, multitudes, fruitful, flourishing all throughout the land, and they fill the land. It says in Exodus 1:7. And so we talked about how last week we go from verses 5 to verse 7 in Exodus 1, 400 years past, 400 years of slavery and oppression, but how God was allowing for his plan to continue in the midst of hardship. And I read this quote by Charles Spurgeon, which I think really highlights what is it that God is doing in the midst of all of this. And Spurgeon says this: God is too good to be unkind. He is too wise to be mistaken. And when we cannot trace his hand, we must trust his heart. In the midst of the circumstance of slavery, it was hard to see that God could be at work. But as we trust his heart for his people, we could see that his plan was continuing on. And today, we're going to be introduced to the villain of this story, who's going to try and thwart God's plan. And then we'll also be introduced to two heroes in the story. And the really interesting part about these two heroes is they essentially just do their job, and that's what makes them heroes. They just do the ordinary thing of showing up for work and doing their job. And as I was thinking about this idea of a big deal through ordinary things, I thought about this article I read recently about the TV show Seinfeld. And the article talked about how what made Seinfeld so popular and loved by so many people was that Jerry Seinfeld would take ordinary, everyday things and make a really big deal about them. So I don't know how many of you are fans of Seinfeld. I've only seen a few episodes. I didn't grow up watching it, but some of the episodes where you see this big deal about ordinary things are like episodes where it's all about finding a good parking spot, and episodes where it was highlighted Jerry's frustration with what he called close talkers. People that get too close and talk too loud and don't understand personal space. And then there was the episode where George tried to keep his high score playing the video game Frogger. It was a really big deal. And there was one episode, though, that for me stands out above all the rest because it became part of everyday vocabulary of Americans, as we would talk to each other. In fact, I used this line on my wife, and she said, "Oh yeah, I've heard that before. I've said those things before." And I asked her if she knew where the line came from, and she didn't know. So it just goes to show that there was a part of Seinfeld that became part of everyday speaking for us that came from the show, and it was this line: "No soup for you." Does anybody remember the soup Nazi episode of Seinfeld, which highlighted the frustration of ordering food at a restaurant and how you always felt like you were on trial to get it just right? And the soup Nazi, when he didn't like how you had ordered or paid or talked or looked at him, he would respond to your order by saying, "No soup for you," and then lead you out the door. It was a really bad business model because you're just losing money, right? Customers, but apparently it worked. Well, this article that I was reading about Seinfeld said that we live in this kind of world. And here's what the writer said: "We are citizens of a Seinfeldian society where only inconsequential things matter." And I thought, man, there is a lot of truth to that. Our attention is consumed by entertainment, not things that have significant substance. And we are increasingly troubled by trying to prioritize between things that have meaning and purpose over things that are mundane that don't really make a difference. We are a culture of apathy, where we're beholden to trying to become famous as our goal for life, only to find that that fame is actually empty. And so we give ourselves to these very meaningless things. There is a hint of truth in how that writer is talking about the show Seinfeld. Well, today we're going to be introduced to two heroes who just do ordinary things. They show up and do their ordinary job every day, and they become the hero of the story. So if you have your Bible, we're in Exodus 1. We're going to start at verse 8, and we're going to read to the end of the chapter, which is verse 22. Then a new king, to whom Joseph meant nothing, came to power in Egypt. Look, he said to his people, the Israelites have become far too numerous for us. Come, we must deal shrewdly with them, or they will become even more numerous. And if war breaks out, we'll join our enemies, fight against us, and leave the country. So they put slave masters over them to oppress them with forced labor. And they built Pithom and Ramses as store cities for Pharaoh. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread. So the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites and worked them ruthlessly. They made their lives bitter with harsh labor in brick and mortar and with all kinds of work in the fields. In all their harsh labor, the Egyptians worked them ruthlessly. The king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, whose names were Shiphrah and Puah, when you are helping the Hebrew women during childbirth on the delivery stool, if you see that the baby is a boy, kill him. But if it is a girl, let her live. The midwives, however, feared God and did not do what the king of Egypt had told them to do. They let the boys live. Then the king of Egypt summoned the midwives and asked them, why have you done this? Why have you let the boys live? The midwives answered Pharaoh, Hebrew women are not like Egyptian women. They are vigorous and give birth before the midwives arrive. A little ancient humor there. So God was kind to the midwives, and the people increased and became even more numerous. And because the midwives feared God, he gave them families of their own. Then Pharaoh gave this order to all his people. Every Hebrew boy that is born, you must throw into the Nile, but let every girl live. This is the word of the Lord. As I said before, today we're introduced to the villain of our story, who we'll get to know quite well over these next few weeks, Pharaoh, the king of Egypt. And we're also introduced to our two heroes, the Hebrew midwives, Shiphrah and Puah. But first, before we get to the heroes, we have to talk about the villain. We have to talk about Pharaoh. And the interesting thing about the way that Exodus describes Pharaoh in this part of our passage is it really ties in to two parts of Genesis. Just like last week we looked at how a part of Exodus ties in with Genesis, the same thing happens here today as well. It says in describing Pharaoh and the way that he's speaking to the people in verse 10, he says to the other Egyptians, we should deal with the Israelites shrewdly. Shrewdly. In the NIV translation of Genesis 3 says that the serpent was crafty, or other translations say cunning, or other translations say shrewd, in describing the serpent. And what the writer of Exodus is trying to get us to see is that Pharaoh is functioning like the serpent of Genesis 3. He is using deceptive tactics in order to distort the truth and to get people to buy into his plan to harm other people. And so throughout this series, you will hear me refer to Pharaoh as the serpent king, because he is taking on a serpent-like persona and way of going about his business. So he's the serpent king. He's fulfilling this role. And the reason he's doing it is he wants to thwart God's plan of blessing over God's people. He wants to get in the way. And then there's verses 12 through 14, which have this interesting connection back to Genesis as well. And it's describing their plan of slavery for the Israelite people. And in verse 14, it says that Pharaoh wanted to make their lives bitter with harsh labor in brick and mortar. And the only other place that brick and mortar is used in the Bible is in Genesis 11. Genesis 11 tells the story about the city of Babel that's being built by the people with brick and mortar. And the goal of the people in Genesis 11 was to build a city that would reach up to the heavens so that they would become like God themselves. That was their goal. And so we can kind of see, I put together a table here so that you could kind of see the compare and contrast of what Exodus is trying to be a fulfillment of. In Genesis 3, we have the serpent. In Exodus 1, we have Pharaoh. In Genesis 11, we have Babel. And then in Exodus 1, we have Egypt. And both of these things, both Pharaoh and Egypt, are like a continuation of the evil that is trying to thwart God's plan, to become like God himself in many ways. And because of this, because Pharaoh is operating in this way, he sees the blessing that is coming on God's people as a threat. He could have looked at the flourishing of this foreign nation within his country as a sign of God's blessing over people that he wanted to be a part of and to figure out how to join with them and receive some of the blessing himself. But instead, he viewed them as a threat. They were foreigners that had to be dealt with and a problem that had to be solved. And so what we really see and what I'd like to highlight about Pharaoh is the evil trajectory of the serpent king. Pharaoh being the serpent king, the evil trajectory. It starts in verse 10. Come, we must deal shrewdly with them, or they will become even more numerous. And if war breaks out, we'll join our enemies and fight against us and leave the country. So his paranoia is that they're within the country, and if a foreign nation comes in as well, that they might join forces with the invaders and then double team them in some ways to overcome the Egyptian people. And so we see this trajectory toward evil by Pharaoh in a few ways. First, it starts with slavery. He wants to make the Israelites work hard to take advantage of the labor that they can bring, and they build these storehouse cities. And part of his hope is that by working them hard is that they'll have less children. They'll be too tired, too worn out, and they won't be able to pursue those the way that the nation is expanding. But clearly, this didn't work very well because he quickly moves on to the next tactic, the second sinister and evil attempt to thwart God's plan is by using the Hebrew midwives. And he goes to the midwives and he says, after the child is born, if it's a boy, before the mom could even tell that the child was alive, kill the child. So he wants secret murder, kind of veiled underneath the surface. He can't totally tell that it's happening. Well, this obviously didn't work either. And his third attempt is the most evil of all. Instead of having the midwives kill the children, he issues a command. He's the king. He tells the people, this is what you're going to do. And it says in verse 22, every Hebrew boy that is born, you must throw into the Nile, but let every girl live. So here we go. A trajectory from slavery to try and wear the people out to secret murder to the most debased and sinister evil of all, open and completely accepted by the country, murder. And so we see that trajectory. We're going to just slowly move ourselves towards something that is kind of subjectively evil to something that is obviously very evil. And any of us could see that. And this brings to mind for me a couple examples within our own time in history as well, where we at times as a society embrace things that might be considered subjectively evil, but only set ourselves up to further embrace things that are more obviously evil in the future. One example of this would be in Canada, has in the last few years introduced euthanasia laws, which are essentially assisted suicide laws, which allow for doctors to kill people who say they no longer want to be alive. And the problem with the laws and the way that they're written is they give doctors a lot of leeway. And now Canada is the leading country in the world for assisted suicide in terms of total number of people who have had their lives taken by the allowance of this law. The law even allows for people with mental health struggles to say that they no longer want to be alive and for a doctor to be allowed to take their life. It's incredibly alarming, even to the point where many of these doctors who have vouched for the program are trying to teach the things that they see as valuable in schools in Canada as well. It's alarming and should cause us to recognize this thing that some people might tolerate leads us toward very dark places in the future. In our own country, there are debates about abortion. Every day, every election, this seems to come up. And the debates aren't even often called abortion anymore. We put more palatable terms on it. We call it women's health care or reproductive rights to make it a little bit more palatable because we don't want to talk about it being the murder of innocent children. Science almost universally teaches that life begins at conception. And so abortion advocates have come up with different ways to try and make this more palatable and understandable for our society. And they've embraced what I would describe as Plato, ancient Greek philosopher, Plato-like understandings about what it means to be human, where they separate the person from the body, that the physical body has no bearing on whether somebody exists fully as a person. It's how we get a DNA scientist who is involved in the discovery of DNA, a biophysicist, said this about what qualifies somebody to truly be a person. He says, no newborn infant should be declared human until it has passed certain tests regarding its genetic endowment. And if it fails these tests, it forfeits the right to life. That's Francis Crick, a DNA biophysicist who passed away about 10 years ago. And the problem that I have with what he says is that a 10-year-old with Down syndrome has, according to him, no right to life, is not able to show that that child is truly and fully human, according to his understanding of the separation of the body from the person. And we see this. And so I'm talking about abortion and euthanasia laws. Like, I recognize I'm getting political, because most of us see these things as political issues, but I'm trying to talk about them as moral issues, as ethical issues, and how they in our society are somewhat subjective. You can agree or disagree on them, but our acceptance of them as a society leads us to more troubling evil in the future. If we can accept this, what will be universally accepted in the future? And it's that kind of idea that we see with Pharaoh. It's his trajectory leads the Egyptian people into an acceptance of something that is obviously evil. And it's the murder of children as they're thrown into the river. And the Hebrew midwives see what is happening and they are defiant against it. And that's the second part of our story. And I would say it this way. The Hebrew midwives save the world. And I know you might recognize that as an overstatement. I'll explain what I mean by that in a second. In verse 17, it says, the midwives, however, in light of Pharaoh's edict for them to kill the children, did not do what the king of Egypt had told them to do. They let the boys live. And one of the really interesting things about Exodus 1 and its description of these midwives is that they're listed by name. Shiphrah and Puah. And you can read through the whole book of Exodus, and Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, is never mentioned by name, not one time. And it's kind of the ancient literature's way of trying to highlight and raise up these two women who are heroes to the nation of Israel and to push down this evil serpent-like man, Pharaoh, who is diminished by the writer of Exodus. And so they are regarded as heroes. Why? Because they saved the world. And let me explain this. Last week we talked about how the nation of Israel had grown to be about 3 million people, approximately, at this time in history. They had flourished and grown. And so it would more than likely take more than 2 midwives to birth all of the children that were being born. Anywhere from like 10,000 to 50, 100,000 babies were being born every year. That's impossible for 2 midwives to bring about to life. That just cannot happen. And so more than likely, these two were the senior midwives. You could think of them as like hospital administrators. They're the ones that established the rules and the code of conduct for how all the midwives operating underneath them are to function and perform their job. And the way that they go about doing their work is a reversal of Eve, and Adam and Eve in the garden. So if Pharaoh functions like the serpent, what does the serpent do? He deceives Eve in order to thwart God's blessing to his people. And what do the Hebrew midwives do? They function deceptively to thwart the serpent in order to bring about life. The serpent deceives Eve to bring about death. The midwives deceive Pharaoh to bring about life. It's a reversal of what had happened in the garden. And verse 17 tells us, why did they do this? Because they feared God. And for the first time in verse 17, God is mentioned in our story. We've seen him kind of operating underneath the surface, carrying God's people through, his blessing over them. But here we have him introduced for the first time. And it's interesting that the first time that God is introduced in our story, it's mentioned that the Hebrew midwives feared God. And it kind of sets up this compare and contrast opportunities or ways to live that we're going to see all throughout the book of Exodus. This theme comes up of who will you serve, God or Pharaoh? Who will you fear, God or Pharaoh? Who is in control of everything, God or Pharaoh? And we're going to see that all throughout the story. Now, certainly, believers are called to respect and pray for the governing authorities of the places that they call home. And even the book of Jeremiah encourages us as believers to care about the flourishing of the place that we call home. But there is an opportunity set before the Hebrew midwives to violate and be disobedient to God with the instructions that Pharaoh gave them. And when this comes up, we as Christian believers, as followers of God, need to be obedient to God before man. And that's what the Hebrew midwives show us. They feared the Lord instead of fearing Pharaoh. And they honored the Lord instead of honoring Pharaoh. And as we'll continue on in this story over these next few weeks, we'll see that these two Hebrew midwives are joined by four other women who save the world. We'll be introduced next chapter, in chapter 2 next week, we'll be introduced to Moses' mother who defies Pharaoh's orders. And we'll be introduced to Pharaoh's daughter who defies Pharaoh's orders. And we'll be introduced to Miriam, Moses' older sister, who helps raise Moses for many years, who defies Pharaoh's orders. And we'll be introduced to Moses' wife, Zipporah. These 6 women save the world. And I said before, I would explain what I meant by that because I don't think it's an overstatement. We talked last week about how God's plan to overcome evil and sin was through the offspring of the woman. Therefore, it takes a family and more offspring to continue down the line until we get to the one who will overcome. And so this family, the nation of Israel that has been brought into Egypt, 70 and now 3 million, is trying to be wiped out. The offspring line is by Pharaoh trying to be cut off. And it's these six women who allow through Moses God's line to continue. They very literally save the world by their obedience. Their obedience to God. And so this chapter one, this second part where we highlight Pharaoh and we highlight the Hebrew midwives, to me, really emphasizes two points that I think are really key for us to grab onto and think about their impact in our own lives. And the first thing is this: God uses ordinary people. In the ancient Near East, women, I don't think I could overstate how little political and social power women had in the society at that time. And yet here we have six women, two highlighted here in chapter one, that are the heroes of the story. God used not even just ordinary people, but undervalued people, overlooked people, to be the heroes of the early part of the story. And we're going to look at the hero of Moses, but Moses is only a hero because he had heroes who led to him being raised up. God used rather inconsequential people in the course of history to save the world. God uses ordinary people. So when we gather in worship, it is not just coming to church. We are engaging in a war, a battle. When you go to your job, when you go to school, when you engage in time with friends or times in a hobby, you're not just doing these things, you're engaging in a battle. Because God uses ordinary people and he is pushing back the darkness as you pursue the thing that he's brought into your life. I love the way Oswald Chambers puts how God uses people. He says, all of God's people are ordinary people who have been made extraordinary by the purpose he has given them. Once God gets a hold of somebody, the possibilities of how their life can and will be used are overwhelmingly endless. We do not stand out as people because we have amazing abilities. We don't stand out to God because we have immense faith or amazing religious obedience. We are just ordinary people. But ordinary people who, through ordinary obedience, surrender themselves to God can be used by an extraordinary God to literally change the world. That's what the Hebrew midwives show us. As I was driving here this morning, thinking about this idea of just being ordinary people in an ordinary church, I was driving by our building, and I thought, you know what? I bet most people drive by this parking lot in this building, even though it got painted a few years ago and looks nicer now. I bet it's just kind of a blip on the radar. Thousands of people drive by our church every day, and we probably just look like, ah, it's just an ordinary church, just, you know, kind of small. You can't see the gym. Our footprint from this road, at least, looks not very big. We don't look very consequential. We look rather, you know, mundane. Just another church, no big deal. But what happens when we are in this place is we situate ourselves around the gospel, the good news of Jesus, which says that God can take you, a sinful, broken person, and raise you to life, that the resurrection can and has happened in our lives. And when God takes a life like that, he begins to transform us and shape us into who he wants us to be. And when he does that, we can become totally new people. It's like what Romans 1 says, I'm not ashamed of the gospel because it is the power of God. So when we gather and situate ourselves around the gospel, the power of God is at work in our midst. And our church begins to expand. Now, obviously, the building's not getting any bigger, but the presence of God fills this place, and our influence in his work begins to expand beyond just ourselves. So we're not just an ordinary church. We might just look like this small building on Portland Road, but we are a gospel oriented people, where we are focused on God transforming and being at work. And because of that, God's work through us continues to expand, and our footprint is growing all the wider, all the time. God uses ordinary people to do extraordinary things. And then the second part that we see with the Hebrew midwives is that the fear of the Lord leads to fearlessness in the world. In Hebrews 13, verse 6 says this quite well. We can say with confidence, "The Lord is my helper. I will not be afraid. What can mere mortals do to me?" In our society, there is a fear that grips the hearts of many. There is uncertainty that often looms inside of our lives. And in our world, chaos seems to reign. And we are reminded that our anchor lies not in our own strength or our own understanding, but in our fear of God. Fear not in the sense of being afraid, but of being in awe, of reverent awe of this God who is all-powerful and in control. And because we have such a deep respect and awe for his sovereignty and his power, we fear him. It's the same kind of fear that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego had in Daniel chapter 3. They said to Nebuchadnezzar, "If we are thrown into the blazing furnace, the God we serve is able to deliver us from it. And he will deliver us from your majesty's hand. But even if he does not, we want you to know, your majesty, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold you have set up." They are an example of how their fear of the Lord minimized the fear of the world. That they had nothing to fear despite being able to be thrown into a fiery furnace. They defied the king's orders, much like these Hebrew midwives did as well. So let us be the kinds of people that cultivate this kind of holy fear in our lives, where we're not taken up by bondage, but instead pursue freedom. That we're not timid, instead we're bold. And that we're not fearful, but instead we're people of faith. You recognize that God can take our feeble offering of obedience to him and do immensely more than we could ever imagine. And so the question that I titled the sermon, "How to Save the World," is seen with the Hebrew midwives. How do you save the world? You save the world just by being ordinary people who are willing to do ordinary obedience before the Lord, before our extraordinary God. And because we fear him and seek to honor him and follow him, he does immensely more than we could ever imagine. That's how you save the world. And that's my charge for us as God's people, to be like the Hebrew midwives, to be ordinary people who are used by God in extraordinary ways. Would you pray with me? God, we thank you for the testimony and example of these two women that we get to think of by name, Shipra and Pua, and the example that they give to us about what it means to live with fear of you. Not fear in that we can't approach you. Here we are coming to you in prayer. Fear in that we're in awe of all that you can do and know that we cannot do it ourselves. We, God, are just ordinary people with struggles and doubts and frustrations and lack of ability. And yet, by the power of the gospel, as we turn to you, you reshape us and you make us new. You cause us to look like what you want your people to be in the world. And so we pray, we ask that you would be at work in us, that you would shape us and mold us into the people you long for us to be. We are ordinary people. We're an ordinary church, God. But we know that when we surrender to you, you can do extraordinary things. So be at work among us. Draw us close to yourself. May we sense your presence. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.